Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This email comes in from Robert listening in the Bay Area. He's listening on our 1260 AM signal up there. Thanks, Robert. He says, during the second hour of one of your shows, you shared about a Chinese saint who was addicted to opium and whom a priest refused to give absolution because of his repeated use of the drug. During the discussion with your guest, I don't have guests on the program, so I'm not sure what you mean. Maybe you're thinking about a caller. But in any case, we don't have guests. We don't do interviews on this program. But in any case, he says, during the discussion, he brought up that he had heard of priests refusing confession to people who had repeatedly committed adultery. You agreed that these priests' decision concerning this sin. You agreed with this priest's decision concerning sin. Your discussion concerning adultery in the Sacrament of Reconciliation brought a memory to mind of a discussion I had with an inmate on my crew while I was working as a baker in a county jail. During the 12 years I worked in jail, I had a number of deep and revealing conversations with men on my crews. In this particular discussion, this man and I talked of addiction. He shared that he had been addicted to both heroin and to sex. I asked him, which is worse? He stated emphatically, sex. I mentioned this later conversation to an administrative assistant who I worked with after leaving the job in the jail. I did not know this woman's history except that she had a troubled past. When I shared the inmate's response to my question, she also emphatically affirmed his answer. I bring these two persons' responses up to related to the extreme difficulty of breaking an addiction. Moreover, a person's addiction does not negate true sorrow and repentance. Thus, repeated confessions of sin connected to addiction can be a sign of true contrition and can be a means toward ultimate healing. A priest who refuses absolution to an addicted person does a disservice, a profoundly destructive disservice to a contrite yet very troubled person, no matter with the person's addiction. A priest who decides to refuse absolution to such a person is refusing God's grace to a person in dire need. Well, yeah. So, Robert, I think maybe in listening to my discussion about this saint, perhaps you conflated what you think is my view of this issue and what happened to him. What happened was, as a Chinese layman, he was addicted to opium. And I understand, I've never had opium that I know of anyway. As I understand it, it can be very addictive very quickly. So I don't fault anybody who falls into that if they get trapped in it. But the whole point of it was that even prescinding from the rightness or wrongness of the priest refusing to hear his confession, the fact is that the man remained faithful. That's the key to that whole story. He was not discouraged by the fact that the priest said, you keep coming here every day, every other day, every week, and you keep confessing the same sin. You don't show any signs of really being sorry for it. Now, granted, this is going back a few hundred years, so the priest maybe didn't have the benefit of some of our current insights into addiction and human psychology. I'll grant all that. And maybe, in fact, in retrospect, the priest wishes, gee, I wish I had handled that differently. I wish I had given him the sacrament of confession and the graces that accrue from that sacrament. I agree with you on that. But that wasn't the point. The point was this man persevered. That was the key to the whole thing, that even in the midst of battling this addiction, he persevered. He kept going to Mass. He didn't receive communion. He hung in there, and eventually he died a martyr's death. Now, I appreciate your email, Robert. Thank you, because it kind of dovetails into another email about the same story, about the same Chinese saint. And although I'm not going to read that verbatim just because it was a longer email, I'll just simply summarize that the person who sent me that email said, you basically kind of like misled the listeners because you said that he died as a saint. The fact is he died as a martyr. That's why he's a saint. It's not because he, you know, hung in there. It's not because the priest wouldn't give him confession, wouldn't give him absolution, and he just remained faithful. But this is me speaking now to that listener. No, you have it backward. That's exactly the reason why he was a saint, is because he died a martyr. And the reason he died a martyr is because he had remained faithful. That's the whole point. In the midst of being rebuffed, rightly or wrongly, by this priest who said, I'm not going to give you absolution, because for the last umpteen times that I've given you absolution, and you say the act of contrition, I firmly resolve with the help of thy grace to sin no more and to avoid the near occasions of sin. Amen. And you keep doing it. That shows me that you're not really truly sorry. Now, I think the priest was probably misreading the situation, and pastorally, in retrospect, that was a mistake. But no, it's not misleading the audience. The whole point of his martyrdom, which I did mention at the end because I read the article on the air, and it talks about him dying a martyr's death. But he would not have died a martyr's death if he hadn't been a faithful, committed, persevering Catholic. That's the point. He wouldn't have been willing to give up his life for Jesus if he hadn't been willing for all those years, stuck in a rut, not able to receive the sacraments, and yet remain faithful. I think you get the idea. It is a powerful story, though. This one comes in from Mary, listening in Southern California. She says, regarding Los Angeles and the homeless mess up here, until a year ago, I lived across the street from a very nice hotel near an airport, while the county of LA took over the hotel to set up a quarantine at home for the vulnerable, homeless, the aged, disabled. And this is during COVID. She says, that was supposed to be 3 months, and it's in its third year. The neighborhood descended into a hellish place of filth, noise, crime, and hostility. The residents of the hotel draw others to sell drugs and camp near the hotel on private property and cars in derelict motorhomes next to my driveway, in front of my home. I felt as though I was under siege in my own home. Even my neighbor was threatened with a gun. LAPD informed us the homeless have more rights than we do, and we were told to stand down. Yes, the rents are so high that even if you have a job, it's not enough to cover expenses unless you have a very well-paying job or two incomes. I'm single. My adult son lives with me. I knew and know my next move will be to a more affordable area, possibly out of state. By the grace of God, I was offered a home that a friend owns that became vacant in Simi Valley at a greatly reduced rental rate. Tenants right now are such in California that they can bankrupt a landlord. So a reliable tenant is highly desirable, and I truly believe the Holy Spirit was the cause of this. Thank you, Lord. She says, I am moved at the sight of young people, homeless, filthy, disheveled, wandering out of the scrub along the railroad tracks and freeways like feral dogs or cats, which are rescued and valued. It's like we are back in the ancient times living like pagans. God have mercy on us. I hear exactly what you're saying, and I know it to be true because, well, number one, being from California, born and raised, I lived most of my life in California. My wife and I moved to Ohio 25 years ago. And although things were not as bad then as they are now, it was still bad. Still many of the things that you're describing, of course, it's exponentially worse now than it was 25 years ago. But I understand what you're saying. And it is, it's pathetic. And I mean that in the fullest classical sense of the word pathetic. It is the pathos of this human misery of seeing these people, including children, who are just derelicts. They're just taking up space, trying to find some shelter, and there's not much more for them. But you know what I blame, or maybe I should say who I blame? I blame the local and the state governments. For some strange reason, in the state of California, which has immense resources, perhaps more resources, and not just financial, but perhaps more resources than any other state in this country, and probably more than many of the states combined, California has the wherewithal to fix this problem if the elected leaders were willing to do so. But for some strange reason, they don't seem willing to do so. Los Angeles is a cesspool. All around, go around the cathedral downtown. I mean, that's right downtown in Los Angeles. And just walk block after block if you dare. And what I mean by that is the potential for crime and other problems on the street is pretty high. And you'll see what I'm saying. Go to Venice. go to parts now, even now, parts of Santa Monica, for example. It just it's getting worse and worse. You've got these tent cities. You've got people living in squalor. It's unsafe. It's just a terrible situation. I don't need to repeat everything that you said because you're right about what you said. But the local and state government, county government, could fix this problem if they're willing to do so. And I don't know why they aren't willing to do so. I don't know if they, doing their political calculations, if they figure that there's some political value to them, that if they can keep people like that on the dole, to the extent they're even on the dole, maybe they can buy them off with emoluments so that they will vote for their particular political party, which of course is Democratic. I mean, the Democrats control all of that. It's on their record. It's on their watch. So I would love to see this problem corrected. And by virtue of being a Catholic, by virtue of being a follower of Jesus, you and I have an obligation to do what we can. But if the powers that be in City Hall, in the county, in the state, if they're not willing to do the things necessary to fix the problem, then the problem remains and the dangers ensue, as you have said. So I can understand why you'd want to be a refugee from that terrible situation. And let's hope and pray that at the very least, maybe some clear-headed leaders will get elected who will recognize the problem for what it is and try to fix it in a permanent and good way. This email is anonymous, comes in asking a couple questions. Number one, I'm an attorney looking for work. I have a job offer to practice family law, which involves matters of divorce, among other things. Obviously, our faith teaches that divorce is not an option when it involves sacramental marriages. Would it be morally objectionable for a Catholic to practice family law or handle cases involving divorce? What about in cases where I'm aware the couple did have what appears to be a sacramental marriage? Now, the second question is, I'm looking for St. Joseph's Baltimore Catechism, and I came across a new edition published by Tan Books. Is the new edition the same as the old one? Thank you. All right, let's start with the second question first, because it's easier. Well, the Baltimore Catechism that I promote on this program is, it's known as the St. Joseph edition, and it's unique because it has illustrations that are very eye-catching. They're very arresting and very interesting, quite frankly. They're from the 1950s. So when it shows like a brand new car, you're looking at like a 56 Chevy, beautiful vehicle, or a 57 Chevy, I guess, is the main one. And that's the one I recommend. It's the same content, but the one that you're referring to is just content. It's just prose on a page. So it's question and answer, question and answer. It's fine. I mean, that's what the Baltimore Catechism originally was. And the Baltimore Catechism came out of the Plenary Council in Baltimore in the 19th century, which was a local or a regional council held by the church in the United States. And this question and answer catechism that was written as a result of this plenary council, that's what the Baltimore Catechism is. That's why it's called the Baltimore Catechism, because Baltimore is the very first of the dioceses in the United States. It's the mother diocese, you might say. So that's the pedigree of that catechism. And it's excellent unto itself. But if you were to hand a fifth grader a copy that's just the catechism with nothing else in it versus handing the St. Joseph edition with the pictures and all that, hands down, the fifth grader is going to be interested in the one with the pictures. No question about it. The same is true for a 20-year-old, same is true for a 50-year-old. It's just more interesting. So it's the same thing in that regard, but the one, the St. Joseph edition, is going to be more effective. That's my take on that issue. Let's see. So attorney looking for work. Well, there it is true that the church, of course, says that divorce is a serious sin. Now, in context, you have to understand that it's referring to the person specifically who seeks the divorce in a way that involves abandoning the innocent spouse. What I mean by that is, let's say that you are the wife and your husband bugs out. He says, I want a divorce. He met somebody else and he wants out. Okay. If the divorce happens, he files for a divorce, you get divorced, you didn't do anything wrong. You did not commit a sin. You are the innocent victim of this kind of a divorce. What the church, by saying that divorce is a sin, is that if you're, in this case, say the husband, and you initiate the divorce because you just want out of the marriage because for whatever reason, yeah, that's a sin because you're not living up to your vows. You're not doing what you promised God and the church and your wife and everyone else, which is till death do us part, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. You're actually going against, you're violating your very vows. That's a serious sin. Yes, absolutely. And the church is really clear on this. But it's not necessarily the case if you're the, it's certainly not the case if you're the victim of a divorce. Now, what about a situation where the husband is violent or he's a terrible, drunken tyrant? What if it's physical violence, verbal violence? What if there's, God forbid, sexual molestation of children or any? There are horror stories that we don't need to even go into, but you can imagine what those would be like. And is the woman committing a sin if she's got to get out from a terrible, life-threatening situation and the only way to do it is to file for divorce? No, she's not committing a sin. The church takes into account these kinds of human dramas. But to answer your question, I don't think it would be a sin to be an attorney working in a firm where you're handling divorce cases, because you may very well be in a situation where you can help somebody who has been victimized. You can give good, sound, moral advice, perhaps even help salvage some marriages. Wouldn't that be great? I know you'd be working yourself out of some billable hours, but wouldn't it be awesome if in conversation with the husband who's about to pull the plug on his marriage, you're able to talk him out of it? Go back to your wife. Go back to her and make this work. That, of course, is the best thing, if at all possible. So on the face of it, no, I don't think you're doing anything intrinsically wrong. Now, if you're an attorney and you're working in a firm in which you have to deal with divorce, and you recognize, I'm going to put you in a scenario here, and you recognize that the guy that you are representing is a scoundrel, and he's told you the whole story. I fell in love. I've been married to my wife for 20 years, and I love her, but she doesn't look like she did when we got married, and there's this really cute girl at work, and we fell in love. One thing led to another, and I really want to be with her. I fell out of love with my wife. I really want to be with her. You know what I would do if I were you in a situation like that? I would, and I don't know if this is technically the correct word for what a lawyer would do. I know judges do it, but I would recuse myself and say, I can't represent you. What? I can't represent you because what you're doing is wrong. I'm your attorney, after all, at least until now, anyway. And my job as an attorney is to give you good advice, good legal advice. And by the way, there are other laws besides the civil law. There's also God's law. And you're violating God's law by doing what you're doing. So I can't represent you. I would do that. I mean, I tell myself I would do that. I think I would do that. Why wouldn't I do that? So who knows? Maybe you can be in a position to help people. But final thought on this, and I'll leave it at that, is if you find yourself as an attorney dealing with divorce issues and you're presented with a situation that you know that if you do this, file this, help with this, that you're actually in some way participating in something that's wrong, that's where I would draw the line and say, I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. Go to him over there in the other office, because maybe he'll do it, but I can't do it. Now, I don't want to be in that situation in any case, but I don't want you to get the impression that I'm suggesting that you have carte blanche. In God's eyes, anyway, I don't think you have carte blanche. There are certain limits and certain lines over which you really shouldn't cross. But that being said, I don't think it would be problematic in itself if you were to take up that kind of law, for the reasons I just mentioned. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll be right back. Catholic Order of... Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, let's get back to the emails. This one comes in from Thomas. He says, I commend some of your listeners who inquire about the depth and details of church teaching and doctrine with you to determine if they are following the faith or are sinful. I've done the same and realized that according to the church, I am committing grievous sins without having known they are such. I do not take communion unless I have gone to confession. That's good. In sharing my learning with Catholic friends, they are astonished about what are sins such as contraception, not accepting the teachings of the church, missing mass, etc. I asked clergy why they don't teach these things so that people are aware. The answer is that the church would be empty, or at least nobody would take communion. It seems to me that ignorance is blessed, and it is best not to inquire. Are priests committing a sin by not informing their flock that they are sinning? Some good stuff here, so let's take it in order. First of all, I'm happy to hear that when you became aware that things were going on in your life that were indeed sinful, that you recognized it and you didn't go to communion until you had gone to confession. That's the best thing to do. That's really the only thing to do. Now, keep in mind that maybe in ignorance you didn't know. Let's just take contraception, for example. I think at some deep level, Thomas, everybody deep down inside in some way kind of recognizes there's something weird about this, something odd about this, there's something not quite right about this. And the more informed you are, the more clear it becomes why contraception is a serious sin. But I think at the very least, some people may have an inkling, let's put it that way, an inkling, an intuition, a twinge that, I'm not so sure this is right, but everyone's doing it. And why not? So ignorance is bliss, like you were saying. So what that is pointing to is the fact that something can be objectively sinful, but subjectively, as far as your own personal culpability is concerned, your culpability might be diminished or even greatly diminished simply because you never knew. Nobody ever told you. Now, that could be your own fault that you didn't know. It could be like, you know, when you heard people talking about Humanae Vitae, that's the Latin title for the encyclical in 1968 by Pope Paul VI, in which he outlines, he in essence reiterates the Catholic Church's age-old teaching that artificial contraception is a serious sin. And perhaps you heard people talking about it, or you know, you have this general hazy notion that the Catholic Church says it's wrong, but you never really investigated it, so you never really know. Well, you could be, what I'm saying here is, you could be responsible to some extent for your own ignorance on the matter, and that would be sinful. And believe me, I'm not like the guy with the metal detector walking up and down the beach looking for sins. That's not me. It's not my job. I'm not looking to find a sin wherever I can. But let's be realistic. There are plenty of ways in which you and I can fall into sin. And in this day and age where there's a lot of moral laxism and to greater or lesser extents, there's not a lot of really good catechesis, unless, of course, you listen to Relevant Radio, that it's not uncommon for people to be, at best, only hazily aware of some of these things. So, yes, if you are aware that, well, I was practicing some form of contraception, I didn't realize fully or in any real way that it was sinful, but now I know, so yes, go to confession. And when you confess it, when you tell the priest, here's what happened, here's how many times it happened, this is the kind of sin it was, it happened, I don't know, X number of times. And I honestly didn't really realize completely that it was a sin. You should mention that. That's different from if you have a stone cold, clear understanding, this is a sin. And if I do this, it's a really bad thing and I'm going to do it anyway. That entails a lot of malice on your part. And this is not what you described. But for somebody to say, I know this is wrong, this is a terrible thing to do, God does not want me to do this, and I'm going to do it anyway, that is the epitome of malice. And you may not have had any of that. It may have just been ignorance. But good that you confessed it. Now, the second thing is, you're talking about people who are astonished when you share with them what you've learned. Well, that's to be expected, I guess, because clearly they're not listening to Relevant Radio, where they're going to get a 24-hour daily dose of the truth, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the teachings of the Catholic Church. And that's a great antidote for the situation that you find these people in. This is why I'd like to take this opportunity to encourage you to encourage them to listen to Relevant Radio. Oh, yeah. You know, there was a time when I didn't know you could say to this person, this is not me speaking, this is you speaking. Yeah, that's right. Contraception is a sin. And there was a time when I didn't know that. But you know how I found out? I was listening to Relevant Radio. You should get the app on your phone. Well, what's that? Oh, it's this great radio network, a global network on the app in roughly 200 stations around the country. You should listen. And you know what will happen to them is what happened to you. You'll begin growing in your knowledge of the truth. And then lastly, you ask about, well, why isn't the clergy teaching this? Now, I don't doubt the fact that maybe some priests or deacons told you that the reason is if I preach this truth and all of it, the pews would be empty, or at least nobody would take communion. Well, I think that's like the glass is half empty versus the glass is half full. And I'm here to tell you, this is anecdotal, but it's still true because I've seen it for myself. As counterintuitive as it might sound to you, those parishes in which the pastor and whatever other priests may be there with him speak the truth in love and tell the people the full gospel, share with them the full gospel, all of it, every bit of it, those parishes tend to thrive. Sure, there may be some people who get their noses bent out of shape and, you know, Father's always talking about sin, or Father's telling me that I can't take the pill, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And they write angry letters to the bishop and they, I'm not going to give any money as long as you're this, that, or the other. You know, let them go. It's fine. Let them go. If that's the way they want to be, if that's, you know, if they're that shallow, if they're that insensitive to the truth, it's like the wind. Just let it blow. It'll rattle some of the dead leaves off the tree and fine, everything's good. Don't be afraid of that is my advice. But speak the truth in love and tell your flock the whole truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And these parishes where the priests do that, they tend to thrive. They have long lines for confession. They have to add masses typically. They get priestly vocations. They get vocations to the religious life. Often the coffers are overflowing. Doesn't always happen, but it often does, that a parish that might be only marginal in terms of what it receives by way of donations from the parishioners can greatly expand what it can do, open a soup kitchen, build a school, all kinds of other things. If the priest is preaching the gospel and teaching the people to love Jesus Christ with all their heart, mind, and strength, and love their neighbor as theirself, and to give full due attention to the teachings of the church, those parishes thrive. I've seen it. So that would be my humble recommendation to any of our esteemed clergy listening right now. Not that you need me to tell you that, but hey, I'm a guy in the pew. I'm in the pew. I'm the guy you're talking to. And I know that when you do that, good things happen. And in parishes where they don't do that, or they just take the easy route and they only preach on comfortable topics, or they only tickle people's ears and tell them what they think they want to hear, or they pussyfoot around things that might be, oh, it's a difficult part of the gospel, so I'm not going to talk about it. Those parishes generally tend to die. And you don't want that. Not to mention the fact that if you're a priest, you're going to be judged by God for how you fed the flock. And I always think back to what Jesus said. He says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And I think that's about as clear as it can make it. Okay, this email comes in from Deacon Timothy on the question of self-defense. He says, I was listening to a broadcast of your program, and a caller called in and asked about the church's teaching on self-defense. I said, referring to me, Patrick, self-defense has to be proportional in that a man with a stick could not be shot by someone defending himself. But this is not true. in some states, even if a totally unarmed person is attacking you, you have the right to shoot them because if they obtain your gun, they have lethal force against you. You simply need to know the laws of the state that you live in. Also, the idea that making guns more difficult to obtain will keep us safer is simply not true. Criminals will always be able to obtain guns. The only people who obey gun restrictions laws are law-abiding people. But we're the ones who need the guns to defend ourselves against criminals who will not abide by those gun restriction laws. Finally, the Catholic Catechism does teach that we have a grave moral duty to defend our loved ones. Just some thoughts for clarification. All right. Well, thank you, Deacon Timothy. I don't know that I needed to be clarified because maybe you and I are talking past each other. I wasn't referring to the laws of the state. I wasn't referring to, oh, well, if you live in the state of Indiana, here's what you have to do. If you live in the state of New York, you have to do this. That wasn't the point of my comments. My point was, what does God's law say? What does the moral law say? And of course, as you know, that transcends any civil laws, any laws from one state or the other. Now, the moral law involves this principle of what is the proportionate use of force in the case of somebody attacking you. So if somebody's trying to punch you or whatever, you do not have the moral right to shoot that person and kill him, because it's far more force than necessary to repel an aggressor. Now, I realize that maybe in some situations you could fear for your life. I'm not disputing that point. But as a general principle, what I was enunciating earlier is that when you are engaged in self-defense, it has to be within proportion. And to use an extreme example, let's say that, I don't know, our neighbor to the north, let's say that Canada is doing something harmful by dumping pollutants into our rivers. I know this would never happen, but let's just say. Well, it's putting people's lives at risk. It's something that is very harmful to the environment, but we don't have the right to nuke Toronto, to destroy it with a thermonuclear weapon, to stop Canada from doing what it's doing. That would be a vastly, insanely disproportional amount of force for something that is a serious issue. So that was the point I was trying to make. And if I was clumsy in making that point, thanks for giving me a chance to do it over again. Now, this is interesting. You bring up the issue about making guns more difficult to obtain will keep us safer. I understand the point you're making, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, because it is true. Look at the assassination of the former Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, which just happened not that long ago. The guy who shot him with a homemade weapon. I don't know if he 3D printed it, but he made this gun at home. It's like a double-barreled shotgun kind of thing. And he killed the former prime minister in cold blood with it. So you're right. People are ingenious and they'll figure out a way to find a weapon. So I don't dispute that point either. But there is an interesting parallel I'd like to draw your attention to. And that is, there is a kind of parallel here with people who say we've got to overturn the laws that permit abortion. And the other side says, well, people are still going to get abortions. Just because you change the law doesn't mean that people are not going to get abortions. It's a very different kind of topic, but there is a parallel here that I see, and that is, nonetheless, sometimes it is the right thing to do to pass laws that restrict certain things that are bad or cause a lot of problems. And I understand the argument very well. The Second Amendment, people don't need to write to me and tell me that not only do we have a right to keep and bear arms, but we have a right to self-defense, and good law-abiding citizens who responsibly use their firearms, they're not the problem. I totally understand it, and I agree with that. But still, I think it's wise. Like, you can't own a Thompson submachine gun. I fired one of those once back in the 1970s? My girlfriend's uncle had and it was illegal for him to have it. I didn't know it till after the fact. He had a Thompson submachine gun. Cyrus, you've seen those, right? With the big round magazine.
Like the gangster?
Yeah.
Whoa.
It's like a big round magazine in the center and then a grip in the front, and you put this thing up to your shoulder. This was the most powerful weapon. It was unbelievable.
And deer better watch out.
Oh, there'd be no deer left. And then what deer you did hit with one of these things would be hamburger. So the only reason I mention this is because I am glad that we have laws that say that kind of high-powered weapon is illegal. You can't have one. And if we catch you with one, bad things will happen. So I do believe that there is room for restrictive measures on certain kinds of weapons. I'm not an expert on them. I don't claim to be. But all I'm saying is that even though it is true that bad guys will get guns and it won't stop gun crime, there is a kind of parallel here too. It was the right thing to do to overturn Roe versus Wade. Even though there will be still people who are going to get abortions, women, even though that's still going to happen, it doesn't mean that it wasn't the right thing to do to impose a restriction on abortion. That's my take on the matter. Quick time out and I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right, wrapping up the show here in this next segment, but we got some good stuff. Thank you for all the emails. I really appreciate it. If you want to send me one, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on Connect and then send the email. I love this one. I can't help myself. I got to read this. This comes in from George, listening on the Relevant Radio app. Just a great, encouraging comment. He says, what a fantastic 3 hours. I think he was listening to the show Wednesday. He says, what a fantastic 3 hours. I thought I would listen for 30 minutes, and here we are at the end of the third hour. Yes, it goes by quickly. The calls are genuinely eye-opening. I love our faith and admire so many people who help clarify our faith. Thank you. Shout out to your sidekick, Cyrus. And I ask the Lord to bless you each day at Mass. That is so wonderful, and I'm grateful for that. Thanks for taking time to share that thought with us. Appreciate it. This is an email from Phil, listening in Minneapolis. We are parents of 4 adult children. The 3 oldest are adopted. Now, I'm just rescanning this email to make sure he didn't at some point say to be anonymous, and he didn't. Okay. Whew. So the oldest 3 are adopted. The oldest, who's in his late 20s, is currently building a house. It's a she. Building a house with a man she's been dating for the last 8 or 9 months. I mention adoption because we do not have a very close relationship with her. The best we can guess is that she has memories of mistakes we made along the way and thoughts and feelings from her own connected to the effect of being abandoned by her biological parents. And it's like a wall between us. I have been to confession multiple times for things that I recall that I did wrong as a parent. I have told my daughter multiple times that I'm very willing to listen to anything she needs to say to me about how I may have failed her as her father. I pray daily for a better relationship. Though we are only a few minutes away from each other, we spend almost no time together and rarely talk because she is busy working 3 jobs, taking classes at a community college, and seems she has intentionally separated herself from us. She professes to be a Catholic still, though she has been honest enough to tell us that she's sexually active. She knows not to receive communion and does join in when we pray grace before meals. My question for you is about going to visit in their new house after they move in. My wife and I do not support our unmarried daughter in her choice to own a house with a man she has known less than a year. I do not want to give any sign that I support what she's doing with this house. I'm not sure that I even want to go inside their house in the state that she'll be living with him in. How do I remain faithful to God and life he calls us to live, at the same time trying to love my daughter who is turning away from God and his ways? With God's grace and mercy, we did have some success as parents. For our other children, descending in birth order, the closer our relations are. I know for the oldest 3, there are things inside each of them about relationships concerning the beginning of their lives that I hope and pray God's grace will touch. And he mentions one of his children is serving God zealously and that they are very close with her. He concludes by saying, I would appreciate any advice you could share regarding this situation. Well, I can imagine how painful this must be, Phil. Certainly because as you look back and you say, man, I wish I had done things differently. Man, I messed up on that one. I missed some really important opportunities. Well, that's life. And we all have to deal with our own feelings of remorse and regret. I have plenty of my own, you know, maybe for different things than you do. But I have my own feelings of remorse and regret and thoughts of, gee, I wish I could do that over again. But you can't. This is just how life is. You have one shot at it. So don't let that paralyze you. Don't let that demoralize you, might be a better way of putting it. And when you go to confession, as you've done, which is great, just tell the Lord, Lord, I struggle with my feelings of remorse for the mistakes that I've committed. And I ask you, Lord, not only to forgive my sin, but heal my emotions. And he will do that. It may not happen right away, but over time, I think you'll probably begin to see that. And keep in mind, too, that it's never too late to be a good father. You can begin again. You can begin right now. And it sounds like you're already doing that. You're trying hard. You're being intentional, as they say. You're seeking opportunities with this daughter of yours that's estranged in certain ways from you. And that takes me to the question about her living arrangement. Well, clearly, she's probably having a great time. He certainly is having a great time because he has something really enjoyable, but he doesn't have any commitment. He hasn't committed to her to spend the rest of his life with her. So he's got, from a worldly standpoint, he's got it made. He's having his cake and eating it too. And that obviously is not a good situation for her. So perhaps one way you could gingerly approach this with your daughter would be to give her a copy of a book that I very much like. I've given them to my daughters. It's called The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. And he may or may not be material for a good husband. I don't know anything more than what you told me. But he also may very well not be the man that God has intended for her. And certainly this arrangement is not the one that God intends for her. But in any case, maybe just get her that book and your wife sign it. We love you, and we hope this book gives you some help, some assistance as you make decisions going forward with regard to potentially getting married. And I wouldn't be surprised if, even just out of curiosity, if she reads it little by little, starts thumbing through it. And if she does, she's going to come face to face with some of this wisdom in the book that's going to show her that this is the situation she's in right now is going down a dead-end street. It's not going to end, you know, with the white picket fence and the happy ending that men and women want. More likely than not, it's going to end in heartbreak and acrimony. I hope that doesn't happen. So maybe do that. But I would continue doing what you're doing. I think it's admirable. Just tell your lover, I love you. Anything that we can do to help you, anything that we can do to show you how much we care about you, we're there to do it. But one thing about loving you is we're always going to tell you the truth. So you've invited us over to dinner in your home. This is where we have a bit of a fork in the road. I'll leave it at this. I could see the case made that you go over there for dinner and perhaps engage in a little bit of evangelization. That could mean that she might get her back up. She might get angry, or the guy might get angry. And that could mean you don't get invited over again. But if you handle it in a diplomatic way and say, well, you know, we love you and we want you to be happy. Jesus loves you. He wants you to be happy. And Jesus said that this is for marriage. Where did Jesus say that? Well, he said it in Matthew 19. This is why, when God created them male and female in the beginning, this is why a man leaves his family and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. His wife. Jesus doesn't say, this is why a man leaves his family and clings to his girlfriend. He doesn't say that this is why a man leaves his family and clings to the woman he's living with or buying a house with. He says he clings to his wife. So Jesus gives us the paradigm for marriage and human sexuality as a commitment between one man and one woman. So perhaps if you talk to her in terms of, I know you love Jesus, and please don't forget what Jesus said, that this that you're doing is for marriage. And it's not just to be enjoyed without the responsibility and the commitment that goes along with that. These are things that you can share with her. I would continue to gently, lovingly share with her. Don't be afraid to talk about these issues. I realize that sometimes people can flare up and get angry, but sometimes that's the risk you have to take. And you have to be willing to take some chances. And sometimes it's well worth the risk to take the chance. And even when it's not, if it does kind of blow up in your face, often those things wind up getting better later. And the son or daughter may come back to you years from now and say, I know it was difficult at the time, and I know I got angry, and I'm sorry about that, but what you said really struck me, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's see. Let's go now to an email from Ann. Now, I'll tell you right up front, Ann, I'm not going to be any good at answering your question, but it's a good question, so I want to ask it on your behalf, and I'll bet you there are some people listening who will have a good answer for you. She says, thanks for the valuable inspiration and guidance you provide. God bless you. I'm hoping that you and or your listeners can provide some help. I'm looking for companies that sell modest women's clothing. Now, she has the word modest all in caps, modest women's clothing. I'm sick and tired of not being able to find clothing that's acceptable. I need something in a petite. I guess she gives me the sizes 0 or 1 or 2. I'm looking for jeans, slacks, dresses, anything that's suitable. I'm hoping there are some people who still take this need seriously. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you for that, Anne. Appreciate it. I don't know like brand names. My wife could probably rattle off a bunch for you. She's also petite, whereas a size 0 or 1, I don't know what it is, but she too is slim and petite. But she dresses very modestly. She looks lovely in the clothing that she has. And I don't think she's buying clothing from any like super arcane or difficult to find obscure clothing line. I'm not saying, hey, she can do it, you can do it. But what I mean is apparently there's quite a bit more available. You have to be picky about it. So maybe what I'll do is I'm just going to put this out there. And if any of you ladies have any suggestions for Anne, don't make it a long email, okay? Just because I probably won't be able to read it on the air unless it's brief. But if you have some suggestions for how you go about doing it, it doesn't have to be a name brand per se, but just like, how do you go about it? Where do you go shopping? I'll even ask Nancy too and get some suggestions from her. But I have a feeling you'll find to your happy delight that it may not be as difficult as it seems right now. But I value the fact that you are intent upon dressing modestly. That's a great thing, and it's a lost art.
I just Googled, you know, yep, modest female clothing, uh-huh, and then I shut it off real quick because I was like, this is really gonna mess up my algorithm.
So, oh yeah, so suddenly Amazon has a different idea of who you are.
Yeah. Well, if Melanie sees it, she'll be like, oh, that's nice. You're thinking about buying me clothes for the first time ever.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the good answer. You don't want to have like some deep, dark secret that only you and Amazon know about.
No. Yeah. No. And there are no secrets on the internet, Patrick.
No.
What you do on the internet will one day be seen by all, I'm sure.
Poignant. Yeah. As they say. Yeah, that's true. Good point. Yeah, well, ask, you know, it'd be interesting as a thought experiment. Ask Melanie. I'm going to ask Nancy.
I will, and I'll put this up on the Twitters, and we'll ask that.
Great idea. You've got some great ideas, Cyrus. All right. This one comes in from Beth. She says, my husband and I sometimes encounter people begging at off-ramps or at stoplights. Along with giving them something monetary, we'd also like to include a business card with phone numbers for local help agencies. That's a great idea. And a holy card for encouragement. But there are so many holy cards to choose from. Which one would you recommend to give? Thanks for your help. Well, you're right. There's so many of them. Maybe one with Jesus, the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Maybe one that's got the Sacred Heart of Jesus and the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Maybe Jesus the Good Shepherd, maybe Christ crucified. He died for you, that kind of thing. One thought comes to my mind, if you're handing these out to folks who are on the streets, not all of whom get into shelter, then I would say try to get laminated holy cards because they're going to be much more durable out in the elements and they'll last a lot longer. But yeah, something like that. I mean, use your imagination, and I have a feeling that people will really appreciate that. I guess I'm a worrier in this regard. I would worry that somebody might profane an image of Jesus, but sometimes that's the risk you have to take. It's like the sowing of the seed. What did Jesus say? You know, the sower of the seed, he goes along and broadcast this seed. Sometimes the soil's terrible, shallow, rocky, scorched by the sun, picked apart by birds, heavily traveled and trampled, and sometimes it's good soil. But I think that might be a good biblical rule for what you're doing here, rather than get scrupulous and think, well, maybe I shouldn't hand out a holy card because that person might disrespect it. It's kind of like the sowing of the seed. You just do the best you can, throw it out there. God will take care of the rest. But I think that's a good idea. One thing as a little footnote to that would be to have coupons. Now, some places they have what's called scrip, which is not money, but it's like a coupon kind of thing where you can exchange it for food or clothing at parishes and things like that. So that would be something that you could look into. Maybe your parish has scrip. Not all parishes do. Another thing you could do is get gift certificates for local restaurants. So even if it's fast food, maybe get gift certificates or the prepaid cards for Subway, for example. Get like a $20 prepaid card. The only place it's going to work is Subway. So, you know, obviously somebody could barter a card like that, but if he's really on the street and really hungry and you give him a card for Subway, he can go get lunch. That's a good thing to do. Well, you heard it. You heard the man. I don't want to be a legend in my own mind.
You're a legend in your own mind.
So we'll wrap things up. Thank you for listening to the program today. Very much appreciate it. And double thanks to all of you who took time to write emails to me. Again, if you want to do that, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on Connect, and you can send me an email. It does come right to me. Anytime you mention Cyrus, good, bad, or indifferent, and it's always good. Almost always. I share those with Cyrus. And you should see Cyrus. He's like a young boy on Christmas morning. His eyes get wide when I show him an email that you sent in that talks about him. He loves it. So
this is true.
Merry Christmas, Cyrus. I'm sure we're going to get some more of those emails after that. Thanks a lot. Until next time, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.